Sunday night in New York, and this is State of the Union, the DC 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. DC 37 is New York City's largest public employee union with 125,000 members and nearly 50,000 retirees. We are part of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, also known as AFSCME. We're on the air Sundays at 8, and we rebroadcast on Wednesdays at 1:30 p.m. We are also now available on podcast on iTunes. Simply go to the podcast app on your iPhone or iPad and search for DC 37 State of the Union. And there are more ways to stay in touch with DC 37 than ever before. You can follow us on social media on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Check out our website, www.dc37.net. And every month, keep a lookout for your union newspaper, the Public Employee Press. That comes to you in the mail. And there is also, if you want to be in touch with this show, stateoftheunion@dc37.net. Our first segment tonight was actually a conversation we had with DC 37 director, executive director Henry Garrido earlier this week. We can take a listen to that right now. This is State of the Union, the DC 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. Joining us now is Henry Garrido, the executive director of DC 37. Good evening, Henry.
Good evening, Chris.
Wanted to talk about the city budget process just finalized recently, and there were a number of issues that were our priorities that we wanted to push through and we fought for over the past few months. And there seems to be a laundry list of things that have come out well for us.
Indeed. I mean, we've always said that a budget is nothing more than a statement of principles, that if those who are negotiating a budget, those who are supporting a budget, believe in certain principles, that they would make sure that they're properly funded. This mayor and, by consequence and continuation, the city council have made a progressive agenda their priority. And among that, it was the idea of the Tale of Two Cities and the reduction of poverty in the city of New York. So we have proposed and pushed and really made a case this year that at a time where there's such an uncertainty on a national level, we wanted this budget to be reflected of those priorities to reaffirm our beliefs here in New York. And they included things like pushing for universal school feeding in the schools, which allow a lot of poor children to be able to receive a free meal in the schools without the stigma of poverty. We have pushed for reaffirmation support of our public hospital systems, which has been, you know, hopefully defunded by the federal government and by the state. We were able to obtain that. And, of course, we push for funding for parks and for libraries, which we think are critical components of not only the education system and the well-being of the children, but also a part of our overall good government policies that we can continue and should continue to fund.
I know that the issue of universal free school lunch is one of high importance to you, and you've spoken about it before. I've heard you speak before about what you have seen over the years, and this, as I say, this fight has meant a lot. Talk a little bit about why this is so important.
Well, this is very personal to me because I started in city government back in 1991, late 1991. Still, when I was going through the latest stage of my college career trying to obtain a degree, and what I saw firsthand back then, what I saw for the years subsequent to that was amazing, was a system that basically stratifies children trying to eat lunch in a social culture that it's already controlled by the government, but we are overtly identifying kids who are poor and putting them in different ways, different lines, different ways to identify them, giving them numbers and rosters and things. And the kids are pretty smart. They figure out which kids are the ones who cannot afford it, the ones that are identified as poor. And many of them, I saw them firsthand, would not get up from that table and eat in order not to be ridiculed by their classmates and others. And some of them, even if they weren't being ridiculed, did it reluctantly and remain hungry, when in fact the federal government funds the program and reimburses the school system for doing that. I thought that was a tremendous problem, and fought for back then as a member of the government, then as a member of the union from day one, have made this a priority. So this is a great accomplishment, because this funding for universal now makes 92% of the schools free of the stigma of the, you know, free lunch, so to speak.
Well, I know that stigma. When I was a kid, if you had the wrong sneakers, you got ridiculed. So imagine if you have to get up because you're a free lunch kid, and how that cuts you off and how you feel about that.
Which is amazing, because the difference between free and reduced lunch and pay lunches in New York are not that much, and they're not as significant as you would think in a public restaurant or cafeteria. But here's a control environment where kids have to come in, and we saw this as an opportunity to move a public policy that was good for the public first, good for the children first, and by consequence, good for the public school system. And yes, the union does have a lot of workers who work on it, and we're hearing their voices too. Many of them are the ones who are having to say no to a child to go hungry because of the stigma, or many of them have had to try to convince a child to come up and be brave and stand up and saying, hey, come on, you being poor doesn't mean that you're any lesser than of a human being. And for that reason, we believe that this is a huge victory for the union, but more importantly, a huge victory for the children and for the public at large.
We also had victories in terms of libraries and school crossing guards.
Amazing. The work that we've done on libraries in the last 2 or 3 years has been, really, really important. We saw 12 straight years of defunding of the public library system. We saw a 30% decrease in budget. We saw a decline on the library personnel as a result of those cuts, around 30%, 32% of the personnel. And we were unable to fulfill a fundamental mission of running the libraries for many of the people that were getting access to it. As a result of our efforts now, this is a straight year with an increase in the funding of the budget. Last year, we were able to baseline it, which was really important. This year, we had a victory of $110 million to fix dilapidated facilities in addition to the operating budget increases, and to make sure that the libraries are good, safe environments where people can participate. And, we did it together, working with the library presidents, with community groups, with parent groups, and we're very proud of what we've been able to accomplish in the library system today.
From the beginning of your taking on the executive director job, one senses a great bit of pride from you on our involvement in the community and how important the community is to your vision for the union. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think that there's been an upward swing that after September 11, there was this high perception of government and government working for the people. With the financial collapse in 2008, there was a reversal of that. Public employees, government were being blamed for the ailments of the community and for higher taxes and less services because of those greedy, underworked, overpaid city workers. And government got a really bad rap. And I believe very strongly when I became executive director that we needed to make sure that our union was just some self-serving entity that was trying to protect its members, but rather than we became the progressive, active advocates of what we wanted to see in changes, not just for our workers, but our community as a whole. And I felt strongly that if we push for agendas that look at the community and the taxpayers' well-being first, as we had done with the white papers and the proposals of insourcing, and do it in a way that was more global and universal, that we begin to align our interests as they've always been aligned with the community, and to understand that that was the message we needed to be part of, I feel very proud that we're beginning to see that trend change in the perception of government now and of unions and the working people higher than it has ever been. And I'm proud to be part of that. And here in New York, more than ever, as a state that remains the last state in the nation, that it's, you know, protecting its interests against the interests of the powerful and the rich. I feel proud of the part that we play here in DC 37 as part of that movement.
So the city budget is, in, as I said, we've had victories there. We've helped communities. The national budget, though, looks like it's going to be quite a challenge in the age of Trump.
Yeah, well, it's incredible. What has been proposed, nearly $3 trillion of cuts in over 10 years in order to pay for a massive tax break for the rich and the ultra-rich. It's an obscene proposition. We're looking at proposed cuts of, you know, the EPA and Department of Labor. We're looking at proposed cuts of, of Medicaid and Medicaid across the nation. Social Security, which was a promise of the president, is being cut as well in order to pay for and continue to support more tax breaks to not only individuals but corporations. It's just an obscene proposition. And here in New York, we in the first year alone, we could see a potential nearly $900 billion cuts that would affect the state. And of that, we would have about $1 billion cut that would begin October 1st. And we're fighting with our national union over the proposal to cut and eliminate and overturn the American Health Care Act and this proposal that the substitution of providing benefits through Medicaid and Medicare to people that need the most needs to be replaced with some sort of voucher system, some sort of tax credit without any price control to the companies that are already, you know, basically, you know, raking the system out through a coal. We believe very strongly that it is more important than ever for us to have a presence and to make sure New York shows the way that we can do things differently in a more humane and a more objective manner and a more manner that looks at people as a whole and not corporation as people. And I think that we have a lot of work to do in that end.
You know, there were union members, working people who voted for this president. And we have been trying to talk on the issues. There's been, you know, there's so much noise, so much controversy these days. But we've been trying to focus on the issues. And I think, talk a little bit, we've only got a couple of minutes left. Talk a little bit about the effects of a Trump presidency on working men and women.
I think there's a natural tendency to try to vilify those Trump voters. And I think that that is a fundamental mistake we cannot afford. You know, whether we like it or not, there were, you know, about 30% of union members in our own union and probably higher in other unions who voted for Mr. Trump. And we need to recognize what, why. You know, and I think the collective anger that had put together in labor against the political establishment of both parties and the fact that this system seems and continues to be rigged from its core so that you know, so much is being discussed about free trade in a way that it depressed wedges and gave more flexibility to corporation and tax systems that would hurt working people and a tax on retirement security for those who are the lower part of the wage pool. And across this country, we saw policy after policy and change after change, all aimed at hurting working people. And that collective anger led to a populism that was not just on the Trump side, also saw populism on the Bernie Sanders side. And we cannot and forget not how this quickly that there were well-founded reasons why people were so angry. And instead of us trying to look at Mr. Trump as an individual, notwithstanding what I feel about him, we're looking at his policies. We're looking at what he's doing. We're looking at, to the extent that those policies are for working people, we would be for it. We have not seen any yet. But to the extent that those policies are going to hurt working people, we're going to attack the policies and not the individuals. And we're going to attack those who support him because of those policies, not because of any individual personality trait. and certainly not alienate those voters who voted for him on that belief.
Henry Garrido is the executive director of DC 37. Thank you very much for taking the time.
My pleasure, Chris. It's good to be here.
And we'll be right back.
Were you a September 11th responder or volunteer? Were you present at the dust cloud on 9/11? Do you live, work, or go to school in the New York City disaster area on 9/11 or in the following months? Do you now suffer from problems such as chronic cough, shortness of breath, anxiety, depression, or have other symptoms? If so, you may be eligible for the World Trade Center Health Program and could receive medical monitoring and treatment at no out-of-pocket cost to you. To learn more about the program and get an application, go to www.cdc.gov/WTC or call 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care. Call today. 1-888-982-4748. 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care.
We're back. Mayoral control has been a huge topic. As this show is being recorded, the debate is raging in Albany over whether or not to extend mayoral control. Mayor de Blasio, at a City Hall news conference earlier this week, called on Albany to extend control of the public schools. Let's take a listen.
Ernie, I got to thank you for your powerful and passionate voice on behalf of our children. My friends, Ernie Logan has spent literally his entire life supporting our children. And he is retiring as president of CSA this summer. And he's done an amazing job for his members and for all the children of this school system. But I want to tell you something that Ernie talks about all the time. How it was a teacher who turned his life around. Ernie Logan's an educator and a leader in this city. It might not have been that way, but a teacher turned his life around. And that is what we are talking about today, whether we are going to continue to give our children that chance to be reached by great educators.
Joining us now is the president of the Council of School Supervisors and Administrators, Ernest Logan. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Chris. Good morning.
I wanted to talk about mayoral control, because although this show is being recorded before we actually know what's going to happen, this is Wednesday morning in New York City, and the show airs on Sunday evening. I wanted to talk about the importance of mayoral control and how we came to have mayoral control and why we need to keep it. And I thought that you were at the news conference with the mayor earlier this week, and I thought that that would give us a good insight into what's happening.
Yeah, thank you, Chris. I'd love to share my thoughts on this. Well, first let me talk about the genesis of mayoral control. Before we had mayoral control, we had what was known as the 32 community school districts, which were elected in an off-time election, which became a place for patronage and patronage mills. And so much was misplaced on what was being done best for kids. So every community had its own agenda of what was going on. There was no rhyme or reason sometimes to what was being done in one district and what was being done in the other. Also, I always believed as an African-American that there was some inherent racism about where you could work at, depending on what your ethnicity was and who you happened to know.
You've seen the system for a long time, right, Ernest?
Chris, I'm in my 44th year between education and the union.
Wow.
And so I've seen it from the role of a classroom teacher, a central administrator, a district assistant principal, and a district principal. So I've seen it in all aspects of it. And I've worked under community control, supposedly, or the community school districts, and I've worked on it with when there's been mayoral control. So I've seen both of it. And I've seen some very, very good community school districts that really worked where people were truly involved with what was best for children. And I've seen something where it's just about power and the war power and political power. And I need to understand something. A lot of people saw the community school board as a stepping stone for higher office. So many times you'll look at the elected officials who are presently in office or used to be in office, and you'll realize it came out of the community school board world.
So you're saying that there was no, it was a stepping stone in terms of politics, and which meant it was a politicized position, or it could be a politicized position. It also sounds to me like you weren't too thrilled about the lack of accountability.
Well, there was very little in the way of accountability. You see, I know the case where Rudy Crew was chancellor, had to dismiss a whole district board, but he had to go through a whole process to dismiss them for their failure really hold anyone accountable in that district. It was a mess. And that was not the only one. There were others that were just doing things that were just because of their political clout, no one bothered them. That was the other thing, which is very interesting. So it was better to have somebody. And the other thing, this is a critical piece here. No one was held accountable. So it was interesting when you would say that the school's not getting funding, the mayor says, well, you know, it's the Board of Education.
Right.
The Board of Education would say, we're not getting enough money to run the schools. You know, that's what the board would say. They'd say, it's the mayor. And he says, oh, it's the Board of Estimate. You know, we went through that whole craziness there. So now, when you have one person responsible, who is responsible for picking the chancellor, then you know who to go to. So, you're right. I stood with the mayor this week, Monday, talking about mayoral control because I believe this is the best way. And I think in my opening statement, I said, I know who to go to when things don't work.
Right, right. It's kind of interesting.
I'm not running around trying to find board members to go to. I go to the chancellor, and when I'm not happy with the chancellor's doing, I go to the chancellor's boss, who's the mayor. So nobody can say to me, I'm not responsible for this. Yes, you are responsible for this.
And the what my recollection of this is that the strongest advocate for mayoral control didn't get it. Rudy Giuliani pushing for, I remember he was trying to beat up Ramon Cortinez at various times about the way things were going, and declaring that if he had the authority and the control, that he would be accountable. Otherwise, he was saying, go talk to those guys. Because
and that's what he did. So then after Cortinez, then he had Rudy Crew, and then ultimately he put pressure on the board to get rid of Rudy Crew and Judy. Rizzo became chancellor for a little short period of time. Then elections came, and then we wind up having mayoral control. But let me just say something to Chris that's critical in this new conversation and argument that we're having now. School governance is separate and apart to anything else that everybody's throwing in here, educational tax credit vouchers or charter schools. Governance is one thing. If you want to really have a conversation about what's best for the school system in regards to parent choice, then the legislature should be having conversations about choice. But you see, they're cowards in that regard because they're not going to separately have a conversation about charter schools or vouchers or educational tax credits because they're not going to get any leverage there and they're not going to get any traction there. There are too many legislative leaders and those involved in the legislature where somebody will then talk about, so tell us about this funding, this money that you're getting from these special interest groups. You know, people like to say it's always the union that's controlling this, the union controlling that. But it's the outside money, the huge hedge fund money that's going into this other part of the conversation. And the only way to get to talk about charter schools, they want to attach it to mayoral control, which has no place in the debate over mayoral control. Governance is one thing. Charter schools is something separate and apart. And I really am disappointed that people who really know should not be matching those two things together. It was wrong before. It's wrong again this time. And I commend the Assembly for saying enough already with this. Let's have a separate conversation about charters.
And as you say, and again, we like to on this show, I always like to try to point out and connect the dots. As you say, there are certain publications in this city that like to declare everything is at the mercy of the unions, when in fact, as you just said, there has been a powerful and rich group of people who have an educational agenda of their own about charters and vouchers, and their political clout now has us in this tug of war over mayoral control and the future of charter schools. And you're
Chris, I think everybody wants to be polite about this, but let's say it where it is. If we were to go back to school boards, and I have a feeling sometimes that people would like to go back to school boards. I watched what happened in L.A. at the last school board election. The amount of hedge fund money that was put into a seat on the school board, millions of dollars, imagine in New York City if we had in 32 community school districts. And someone decided that, you know what, we're going to have enough money, we're going to take over this district, and we're going to have a power to do whatever we want. So the hedge fund money, the outside money, can come in and swing it. It will not be about what the public wants. They'll make it appear it's like the public wants, but they'll put so much money that they will delete the parent involvement, the community involvement in this, and they will basically control the message. And that's what you need to be careful about. So I'm always, I look at it on both sides of this. I always tell people I'm the pragmatic union leader. I see both sides of this. I understand the right, the left. I understand the center. We need to decide what is best. And in this situation here, mayoral control, we should be talking about what's best for the children of this city. And the thing that's best for the children in this city, you need to have one person who's in charge, one person you hold accountable, and you know when things don't work, that's the person you go to. And that then the mayor, when you run for mayor, you understand that schools is the first thing that people are going to look at. So you're responsible for making them work, good, bad, or ugly. You're responsible, and people hold you accountable. So let me just move fast forward here. This mayor, I have not always agreed with what he's talked about and what he's done. This chance, I haven't always agreed with what they've done. But I'm looking at the numbers here. They made some strides here across the board and in every district. So for the first time, Chris, we're seeing every district making gains.
That's terrific.
Some of them, less gains than others, but they were always behind, but at least they're all moving in the same direction. And that's different. So you even based on the whatever the rubric is for being successful, okay, they're in the steps for being successful. Do I give them an A? No. But I give them a high. I give them a B, a good B. I think they're working at this.
Ernie Logan is the president of the Council of School Supervisors and Administrators. I very much appreciate your coming on the show and talking about this. It's a very smart conversation. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Chris. Look forward to joining you again.
Okay,
have
take
a great
care.
Day.
Take
okay,
care.
Bye-bye.
That's just about all the time we have for this week. Before I go, I want to give one announcement. The DC 37 Organizing Department is holding lunchtime meetings at various sites and dates citywide to remind you to vote no this November on the ballot question regarding the state constitutional convention. For more information, call 212-815-1095. I want to thank our guests, DC 37 Executive Director Henry Garrido and Ernest Logan, who is the president of the Council of School Supervisors and Administrators. The producer is Rudy Orozco. The sound engineer is Andrea Minocchio. I am Chris Policano. Until next time, ciao.